Mr. Whalen is here, and we've only been at it for a little over 45 minutes. So, Scott, if you're ready, I'll take up item six. Are you at a good place to go?
I am, but first, what did I miss, Todd?
I'm retiring next month.
Oh,
Yeah,
well,
so I have one more board meeting.
that makes me sad because COVID's still going on and I haven't seen you in so long,
I
but
know, I know. Well, maybe
congratulations.
I'll keep an eye on a future agenda and come say goodbye properly then. But
Congratulations, that's fantastic.
in the meantime, we'll start item six. Consider and take possible action to amend the investment policy statement. Mr. Whalen, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So this is all about needing to update the investment policy statement to reflect the new strategic asset allocation that was approved late last year. As part of this agenda item, there were three documents that were included. The first was a brief memo describing what we did. The second is a redlined version showing exactly what we did. And then the third is the final document. So to explain this, I'm going to walk through it and then really just kind of look to you for any questions or comments. And we needed to update the policy statement to reflect moving from 4 years to 3 years in the liquidity sub-portfolio, adjusting staff investment authority to reflect plan asset growth and higher allocation to private markets investments. And then just, you know, as a general periodic cleanup, read through the entire document looking for nit improvement opportunities and make it a little bit tighter. Your internal legal counsel and your external fiduciary counsel have had a chance to review the document and make adjustments as well, just as an FYI. And then if you had a chance to review it, I'm just going to go through those three areas and provide you with a high level explanation of what we did. First, with the liquidity sub-portfolio, the changes were made on page 11 and page 12, pretty straightforward, to change numbers from 48 to 36 in the case of the target, and from 24 to 18 months in the case of the minimums. And then it was done in two sections, right? It was first done in the liquidity sub-portfolio section on page 11. And then there's also some reference in the interaction between sub-portfolios where it talks about replenishing the liquidity sub-portfolio and rebalancing. That's on page 12 and 13. So that was that, pretty straightforward. The staff authority question, that's in section 2I, hiring a new manager on page 6. And we believe that it makes sense to reasonably increase the authority based on portfolio growth, based on the growth in the illiquid bucket. So if you think about the growth in the portfolio that went from 7 to 10 billion over the time period that we're talking about, and then the increase in illiquidity, the illiquid investments from 32% of the portfolio to 41%, that's a little bit more than a double of private markets investments from 2 billion to 4 billion. And so that $100 million authorization limit is really sort of antiquated. So we're recommending increasing it from 100 million to 250 million based on that asset increase, and also really based on the fact that staff has done a great job and been very effective in allocating assets to private markets. And then we're also recommending changing the metric from committed capital to committed but undrawn capital, which we think is just a better reflection and will allow staff to manage the investments to target more effectively, given the uncertainty of cash flows due to capital calls and distributions. So that's that one. And then the other really was just, you know, a matter of sort of putting commas in some places, taking commas out. There are a couple of examples that I think were pretty indicative of the highest level of impact that some of these nit changes would have on the portfolio. There were some wording changes, one on page 5, Well, I actually think this was Karen's addition where she added a phrase around parameters instead of just saying that, you know, you've got to be in line with this. We added the phrase around parameters to be in line with this, just a wording adjustment. And then on page 11, another one was we changed will to may in terms of how the liquidity portfolio will be invested. So will implied that you would have all the things that we were talking about, when I think the intent is really just you may have these things. You don't need to have all of them. So it was things like that that were changed to kind of tighten things up. And with that, I will stop talking and see if there are any questions or comments.
Questions for Scott?
I guess I could. You didn't touch on in your overview, Scott, the recommended change regarding trustee involvement in due diligence or interviews, and I don't know whose changes those were, whether those were various recommendations or staff recommendations, but if you could touch on that.
Yeah, so that came about through discussions with myself and Tim, and the idea was to clean it up to not eliminate the opportunity for trustees to stay involved in due diligence where they would like to be, but just kind of clean up the language. It was in a couple of places, and so we took it out and just made it generic in one place and said, you know, if trustees want to be involved, they can, and they'll be notified when the opportunity exists.
Okay. So I guess feedback on I'll start on that issue. In terms of looking at the proposed adjustments, for me, there are sort of two core areas. One is the role or participation or lack of thereof of trustees with respect to the investment decisions and monitoring of you know, the investment house. And then there's the second issue of the funding limit cap, because I think there are a few folks that have a similar concern about it. But let me just take on the trustee one. I don't have an answer, but I want to at least raise the issue. And we all know that at least several years ago, certainly was the case when I came on the board, that the whole process was very different. Trustees made decisions about managers based on consultant vetted shortlisted folks with, you know, within a strategy. And then we had them come in for 20 or 30 minute interviews, and then either based on a recommendation or typically not, but amongst a group of three, the board chose amongst those. I realize we've completely swapped out of that paradigm. We're in a completely different environment where we have developed an institutional framework where our CIO manages the investment side of the house. We're no longer in the business of beauty contests, if you will, picks of consultants, managers, and so forth. That said, here's the issue I want to throw out to people. I'm concerned about increasing sort of attenuation between our role as managers of the system and of the ultimate performance of the system and what's actually happening on the investment side of the house. And Tim, I'm sure, knows that I'm not saying anything that cast any doubt or concern. What I'm talking about here is a structural issue. We're responsible for the performance of the fund. We're responsible for what happens. And under the new paradigm, our apparent authority and role is more about making sure we develop process and policies that serve as safeguards for the maximum performance of the investment side, that we've instituted sort of these safeguards, these processes, our due diligence so that we can say we did everything possible to ensure it, to ensure the fund's performance to meet its targets and so on. The problem I'm having is I feel more attenuated from the investments now than ever. And part of that's because so much of what happens on the investment side is at a high level of sophistication. I think through some of the presentations we've had, very complicated stuff, you know, we're not experts. Some of us are. Jay knows a lot more about this than I ever will. But it's one of these things where you can really feel attenuation from the subject matter. And there's an increasing sort of black box aspect to how a lot of these investments work. This isn't your simple bond scenario or simply looking at investments that generate X amount of income and you can look at dividend ratios and so on. This is so far beyond that. That where we have a lot of our money deployed. It's a very sophisticated system. So that's the long-winded tee up to, in terms of trustee roles and involvement, I was a little concerned at the edits seemed to reflect a disinterest in having trustee participation, sort of making it we have to ask and then only as appropriate, using the term that's in the draft. So I wanted to throw that out from my perspective. I don't really know what role trustees should have. I just know that in having participated in due diligence interviews, at least you get a peek inside the you know, curtain. You get to part the curtain and see a little bit of how this actually works and what those interactions look like. And I was fortunate in one sense that on my very first foray into this, I happened to be able to attend some manager visits that were not easy ones. We've had some issues. I know this is a public meeting. I'm not going to get into details. We had some issues with a couple of managers that caused us to need to have interviews directly with those managers. I was able to attend those. And it was remarkable to me to see that interaction in real time and to see how it actually works at that level and what that real dialogue is between our investment side and those managers about whether it's fund performance issues, personnel changes that we weren't told about, things of that nature. Unless you've done that or know what that is, I don't know how we have a deeper appreciation from where we sit now in terms of overseeing the investment side to understand it enough to know what it is we're monitoring. Because I think ultimately our goal in the policy is that we're monitoring the investment side as fiduciaries in order to ensure that it meets the objective. So I'll stop talking. I know I went too long, but I wanted to convey that sentiment. I don't have an answer, but I did have a reaction to what appeared to be a further downplaying of the need or role of trustees in the investment process. I'll stop there.
Well, I guess I'll ask a follow-up question to those comments, those great comments. And that is, the intent is not to eliminate trustee involvement in the due diligence process. It's to make it as efficient as possible and to include them where they would like to be included. And so what you're saying is the language doesn't reflect that intent.
Correct. In fact, I don't even know how we would know other than quiet period notifications. I guess that's maybe the only notification we would now get as to the status of any particular due diligence activity. I may be wrong, but I at least that's my sense, is that that's the trigger we get now that would tell us, oh, we're looking at XYZ manager and we can't have any contact and so on.
Okay. So I will propose, not trying to cut off conversation here at all, but just trying to propose a solution for the sake of efficiency. Perhaps we can, depending on whatever additional conversation takes place on the changes that have been made, perhaps we can approve the changes that we're comfortable with, and maybe it'll be everything but that change, and then we can continue to work on that and bring it back to the board.
And if I could just ask for one clarification here, Scott, I'm hearing, or Trustee Gordon, I'm hearing kind of two parallel issues here. One is, why was the language changed around participation in the due diligence process? And the other is really, this question, and I think it's a very valid question for every trustee, what truly is the role of the trustee? And I think that latter question, I would ask, Scott Whalen to address regarding the exact language changes embedded in the policy statement. I think one of the goals that we need to be clear about here is that We want to make sure that due diligence happens in a streamlined manner. And some of the reflection there was to say, you know, trustees are always able to observe the process. What we didn't want was to say due diligence is the role of a trustee, because that crosses into putting the fiduciary, putting a different type of fiduciary responsibility back on the trustees when you have incomplete information. So it was there's a long process here. You can observe it. And I think, and so that in my mind doesn't change very significantly with the current process here. We can notify you of a quiet period. If there's a question, if you'd like to participate, you let me know at that point in time. There's also on, I guess, section 8, portfolio monitoring, on page 13, there is the language in there that, the board may determine from at any point in time that you want to meet with the manager. And so that, that remains. And so if there's a question from the trustees saying, hey, XYZ manager is causing me heartburn, or I'm not understanding the process and I want to, sit down with them, that remains there. So that ability to say, I'm not getting what I need from, the various reports, from the staff reports, I want to talk directly to the manager. Trustees still have that, that capability. But everything that was done in the language changes was there more to say, I think some of the past language implied that trustees were conducting some of the due diligence or somehow more embedded in that. And we wanted to say, this is an observance process. I think your comment, Scott, was dead on. Like, we've gotten to the policy level, you've put the implementation pieces in place where you can understand that there's a process being followed and the logic being followed. And if you want to observe that in real time, you can. But we wanted to make clear that, there was a policy level role and there was a operational role, and the two were distinct. And that was really the goal. And if we need to change the language to further firm that up, that's fine. But I just want you to understand what some of the goals were there.
Well, that's helpful. My sort of very high level takeaway was that the edits suggested that there was more discouragement than encouragement in any participation. And I mean, no slight to anybody. I'm just saying that's how it read to me. So it's all about, words and what different people think they mean. But at least from the standpoint of where I sit, the edits tended to suggest discouraging involvement. I can't imagine you want to conduct due diligence interviews when, three or four trustees want to tag along, and all of a sudden you're having to hassle with the care and feeding of trustees while you're trying to conduct due diligence. I get that's not going to work as a general rule, but I am concerned about the degree to which we get further attenuated from what actually is a specific investment and understanding manager interactions. I mean, I found it remarkable. I don't want to overstate it, but in the first couple of years of attending some interviews, to see how those conversations really go and how candid and frank they can be, and they are. It was surprising to me in one respect, but it is what it is. But all I'm saying is, if we're here as fiduciaries managing this, we ought to at least know at some level what if we want to or can or have the time to do it, what it is we're managing and being responsible for and trying to monitor. So anyway, that's from a policy perspective, I would want us to maybe more encourage without hijacking the process, at least more encourage trustee participation if desired, and to have some adequate means of knowing when those opportunities are.
I completely agree with you, Scott. And thank you for saying that. And we should be more involved. I don't think if the trustee asked to go along or what, I think the trustee should be encouraged to participate. It helps with us fulfill our responsibility. It's very educational. And it also gives us an opportunity to see how our investment team works. And so we have a better understanding of this whole process. So I think trustees should be encouraged to attend due diligence meetings. I agree with you, Scott. Thank you for saying that.
I'll just add a little bit of additional color to that, to the conversation, and remembering back when Harvey did his fiduciary education two or three meetings back, and the subject of meeting attendance and due diligence participation came up. And I think the point Harvey was making was that observation is fine. Involvement in due diligence is not best practice, which actually from an investment perspective, we find to be the case as well. So just differentiating back to Tim's point about the role of trustees in due diligence, observation for understanding and education and knowing the process, great. Participation from in due diligence from a decision-making perspective, a little bit different. So just wanted to clarify that differentiation there.
Yeah, but Scott, we vote on this, right? I mean, the trustees vote on the major investment decisions and so forth. So it the buck stops with us. So we need to be involved in a meaningful way at some point. And I think observation is fine. I mean, like I said, it's very educational and so forth. But I'd like to know what we're investing in and understand the strategy better and understand how our investment team works better. I think it's a positive.
Yeah. And so I'm in the uncomfortable position of pushing back a little bit on trustee opinion. But I think that from an investment perspective, you as trustees, your role is to set investment policy, monitor investment policy, and maybe that's what you're talking about. But delegating a lot of the investment decision making and the analysis and the authority to the experts, and it's just a matter of where that line is drawn.
Scott, that was the point I really wanted to raise. Operational review now is moving under the new terms from $100 million. To $250 million. The issue, it seems to me, is where that number ought to be. We're agreeing that there is some point at which we as trustees should have some input on policy, and we're moving that input level from a big number to begin with to a much bigger number. So my suggestion to you with Tim is spend perhaps some more time on this reevaluation of at least that aspect to whether or not 250 is the right number. It just feels awfully big to me.
I've always had a fondness for the pendulum theory. And in reading this, I just had this feeling somehow that this pendulum is now swinging past its midpoint and headed in not necessarily the wrong direction, but a very much different direction. I have the advantage of having been through some of the beauty contest decisions and presentations. And I think this has been a good move on our part to get away from that, because I felt there was far more attention to detail, I guess meddling, I would even say, by board members when it came to the selection of investment managers. But perhaps in this case, our CEO is to some degree a victim of his own success. And that means that we're in danger, not danger, I don't want to use that word. We're facing the possibility of letting that pendulum swing too far the opposite direction, so that board involvement is simply upon request. The dollar limit is moved to an extraordinary level, in my opinion. And it almost leads the outside viewer to be able to look at this and suggest that the board's investment involvement is minimal and simply perfunctory. So I get this feeling somehow that this pendulum has now swung a little bit too far, and I would encourage some look at the global changes that are being suggested and find out what other points of view we might be able to incorporate and some reconsideration of that dollar limit.
Okay.
I just had a couple of comments here. It's a very interesting conversation for me personally, because as a staff member at another plan, I'm usually on the other side of asking for more staff discretion. So in this case, I think I would agree generally with a lot of the comments. Keep in mind, though, that the impact of the board is still supreme here, in the sense that we're deciding asset allocation, and it's the asset allocation of the plan that's going to drive the vast majority of investment performance. So the kind of manager level choices that Tim and staff are making certainly are important, and they're the ones that people can kind of point out. But at the end of the day, the performance of the plan is going to be largely driven by the asset allocation decisions that the board is making. So that move, really the most significant impact or change in this IPS is the changing of the liquidity portfolio, the resizing of that portion of the plan. So I wouldn't downplay really the kind of impact that board members have here. It's just kind of the level at which you're making decisions. We're making policy choices now that kind of change that whole sandbox, rather than looking at the individual grains of sand in that box. And whether trustees want to tag along on due diligence visits or not, or how that's implemented, that's kind of there's a lot of different ways to do that. And personally, I found that you don't really need the most sophisticated financial background to ask really good questions. The best questions are just, does this make sense? A lot of the time, coming from a blank sheet of paper is often the best perspective. And, we're much more likely to stick with the strategy and support it in the long term if, as trustees, you understand what's going on, right? It's much easier to redeem from a strategy that you didn't buy into in the first place. So I would overall kind of support the continued delegation of selection and review to staff. I think that makes a lot of sense. I would suggest maybe that there might be a presentation or some re-underwriting of the process itself. So maybe if trustees felt more comfortable with the due diligence process itself and kind of knowing the checks and individual steps of how managers go from kind of prospect to getting funded, maybe trustees will get more comfortable with that and more willing to continue the delegation and even increase the delegation in terms of size to staff. But overall delegation at that level, I think, makes a lot of sense.
If I could ask Tim, usually when I increase the authority to any executive director, or in this case the CIO, it's because there's a demonstrated need that they can't really manage the day-to-day operations, or it's just very cumbersome to come back to the board to ask for that to be approved. And so as has been suggested, jumping from $100 million to $250 million is a pretty significant jump. But it's helpful for me to understand, Tim, is does it hinder you if we don't give you that authority? What if we went to $200 million? Would it hinder you to have to say, okay, wait, hold on, I can't, decide yet. I've got to bring it back to the board first for their approval? Because I clearly, again, sometimes deals are made quickly. Sometimes things have to happen quickly. And our goal of giving you this authority is to not encumber you in any way, but at the same time, balance that with our oversight.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to address that. Thank you, Supervisor Anderson. I think that's a very pertinent point here. I would just, before I address that, I want to emphasize that there is a structured staff review process. It is highly documented how managers come on our radar, the initial level of inquiry, what we do at what point in time. When we enter the due diligence phase, trustees are notified of the quiet period, because now we're at a, you know, high degree of likelihood that we're moving forward with this, and we kind of insulate that manager from board level discussion or from individual trustee communications, and take that through the underwriting process. So there is a very structured process, and I'd be happy to present that to the trustees again. But I think using that structured process, we're at a point now, and this is particularly relevant to the private equity program, and I might ask Rishi to kind of talk about the competitive landscape here as well. But we're at the point where we've increased the private equity allocation. We've increased the total size of the fund. You'll recall when StepStone comes in and talks about the pacing analysis, we're now kind of stepping up to more dollars per year committed in the private equity space. And the $100 million, is a sticking point here, where if our bite size in the past had been $25 to $75 million with pretty much a $50 million midpoint, now that really becomes more of a $75 to $100, $125 million bite size. And so to be able to move through the process efficiently, we are asking for a higher dollar limit there. If the trustees aren't comfortable with the 250, I think there's certainly a conversation to be had to say, where do we see a friction point? Where do we see something that encumbers the underwriting process, something that that starts to make us less competitive in the marketplace? Because unfortunately, private equity land is still, we are having to position ourselves competitively to get access to the best in class funds there. I think the $100 million certainly has become kind of a constraining point here. But we can talk a little bit about the pacing and what we're looking at going forward there. And Rishi, maybe I could ask you to kind of chime in here and say, where are our bite sizes migrating over the next couple of years here in order to get up to that 15% private equity allocation that the board approved back in December?
Sure. Thanks.
Actually, before we get to Rishi, I just I want to kind of just follow on to Candace's comment. When it talks about being able to operate or hamstring our ability to do what we need to be doing, I think that the discussion from the 100 to 250 is really around those managers that are doing well for us that we want to continue providing resources potentially, and not necessarily being hamstringed by being able to do that. I mean, I see that as, one of the biggest reasons why we're having this discussion today, not only the increase in that sub-portfolio bucket, but as well as, we want to continue to provide those resources to the managers that are doing well. And so I just wanted to make that point before Rishi continues. And I also wanted to mention on the due diligence point, I could see, you were provided with a red line of the revisions in the IPS. Some are red, some are purple, some are green. But, it is crossed out in here that the CEO maybe won't be inviting trustees for due diligence. And so it could be read as, the board is no longer invited to do those types of things. And that's not the case at all. I think that these revisions are really reflective of, a change in direction of the board over the years, as has already been mentioned, but also the activities of the trustees, and that there has been, reduced participation in the due diligence activities. And so it's more of, moving from, oh, everyone's invited. Oh, we really want your participation in this. We really want your input. And moving more towards, if you're interested, yes, you're welcome. And maybe the other part of that is where it talks about as appropriate and upon request. I mean, it's always appropriate for trustees to know where the dollars are going and who's managing those dollars. The focus obviously now is more on the asset allocation, and, there's been a shift over time to moving to a better governance model. But I think I just want to caution not necessarily tying to certain words, because we can always change these words. And this is the IPS for the board to adopt. And so, you know, this is a red line to have, you know, a good fiduciary discussion, which I think is occurring today. And if there's some tweaks that need to occur around due diligence, you know, let's do that. But I just wanted to mention that before Rishi talked a little bit more about private equity, because that's really the main reason why we're having this discussion on the dollar limit today. So go ahead, Rishi.
Well, actually, let me just provide a little response to that. So words matter in the sense that, it's our board policy and it's our investment policy statement that we're looking at. But, you know, the beauty of Redline in the modern age is that you get to see what's stricken, what's replaced, if anything, and that very action itself connotes often an intent or a desire. So, we can read lack of overt encouragement and solicitation for participation as one thing, but we can read it as a discouragement just as easily, because it certainly came across that way, just based on the, remember, this is, I'm not reading a memo or an explanation, I'm just reading the text, right? Just looking at the red line and strikeout and trying to make a judgment about it. So it looked very much to me more of a discouragement. You don't need to know, we'll take it from here. And I'm not imputing bad motives, I'm just saying it could be read that way. So it's one of those things where the words do matter, at least from where I sit. So I think we want to get that right. And what I might say about the dollar, I appreciate John and Jerry's thoughts on the dollars, and Candace spot on in terms of, you know, tell me the why of the change, because we're not trying to hamper anybody in their job. And has this become a sore spot? Probably. In reading the statement change from 100 to 250, it's more than a quantum jump. So it's not insignificant. So it probably needed a little tee up, if you will. Maybe that's what's happening now. But that it probably needed a little tee up to understand the rationale for that degree of a change and whether it's necessary, because I think it struck a number of us as being a huge number. Four investments is $1 billion. Think about it. It's $1 billion, four different investments, four managers. That's 1/11th of who we are. So just put that in perspective. Anyway, Rishi, we interrupted you, so I'll stop there.
Can I just add one other little thing? Not to pick on individual words, I'm sorry, but one of the changes on page 6, I just think to the outside reader, when it suggests that board members may observe the due diligence process as appropriate, an outside reader could look at that and ask, when is it ever inappropriate
exactly. For
a board member to ask about an investment of perhaps $250 million? It's not what I think is intended by the way it's presented, but I think an outside, uninitiated reader could somehow read those words as being, we're discouraging. I agree with what Scott's suggesting. So not to nitpick, but that's just an example of a conclusion that an uninitiated reader could come to.
No, I appreciate that. And it's funny, you talk about wordsmithing by committee, right? And it's usually a bad thing, but I appreciate all the feedback. It's good stuff.
Okay. Hi, everyone. This is Rishi. Just to provide a little bit of context, I think Scott had mentioned earlier the private markets program, you know, at 40% target with a $10 billion current plan size is about a $4 billion portfolio. I think looking at the actuarial projections, I mean, who knows how the plan will perform and how things will play out, but by 2025 to 2027, I think that number becomes around $5 billion. We've spoken a little bit about private equity. I think the private equity program, obviously at today's dollars, would be targeting $1.5 billion. I think that becomes about $2 billion by 2025 to 2027. As you all know, we have a fund of funds portfolio, legacy portfolio there that's running off. And so we need to put capital to work in primary fund investments to fill that gap. And a lot of those investments are new managers that we're bringing on, because we don't have the benefit of being able to re-up with fund-to-fund managers. And so, you know, what that all sort of boils down to is the pacing that we're going to need over the next 5 to 7 years is sort of in the $200 to $350 million range per year. And, you know, we're targeting to try to be at that sort of 75 million plus level per fund manager. The reality is sometimes we're not able to get that allocation with the best managers. We might be at 50. But if we, you know, we're at the 75 to million plus range, what happens is those managers are typically coming back to market now every 2 to 3 years. And so, you know, for the first commitment that we're making with this $100 million minimum maximum that we currently have in place, we're able to do that with staff discretion. The second commitment, you know, at the current level would likely need to come to the board. And so I think, you know, what that would mean operationally is we're probably looking at, you know, anywhere from call it 5 to possibly 7, if you include real estate, possibly more funds that need to come to the board on an ongoing basis, because managers are, you know, they're not doing round trip investments where we put the capital to work, they sell the investment and we're out of it in 2 to 3 years. It's just that they've invested the capital in 2 to 3 years, but that capital continues to be at work, you know, for the term of the fund, which can be up to 10 years. And so, you know, just to focus more on operationally, what it looks like is bringing that many funds to the board on an annual basis. And then maybe I'll just provide a little bit of context for sort of what's going on sort of on the ground with private equity and how we're able to be competitive and how we've been able to be competitive so far. And you guys, you've heard me say some of this before. So, you know, I think the stable capital base that we have and that's provided by our members allows us to be competitive. I think having, you know, a team being able, having the relevant experience, being able to properly screen and due diligence and speak the same language as these private equity managers, I think that helps. And I think our efficient investment process also really helps us to get access to some of the best managers. I've been very happy with our batting average so far, getting access to some of these best managers in the market. And I think our investment process has helped that. I think, you know, for a few reasons. I think first, those managers are obviously building long-term relationships with CICERA. And, you know, I think they need to become comfortable with us. In many cases, they have LPs who've been in their LP base for, you know, 15, 20 years. We're a brand new investor to them. And they need to find ways to become comfortable with us. Us being a California public pension plan, you know, one of the concerns is sort of how their information is going to be disclosed. In our processes, you know, them dealing with staff, proprietary information being protected as due diligence. I think that's helped us to get access to some of these managers who, again, they get to choose their partners. And then, you know, obviously I think being able to interact with the team and knowing that the team that's going to make the decision is intimately involved day to day in their evaluation reduces uncertainty in their process as they're trying to bring LPs on. And I think that also helps us. But I've said a lot, I've spoken for a long time, so I'll pause there. My goal was to try to just provide some context of sort of what's going on the ground and operationally what this could mean for us, you know, whether we increase our discretion amount or not. I think last point I'd make is I think to the managers in our program right now, not increasing this dollar amount to them, it sort of looks a little bit like a change in our process, because the first commitment we made with using staff discretion, and the second commitment would be a slight change in process to them. So to them, it could be viewed as a slight change in process, and that could make us less competitive. But it's hard to speculate on that point.
Yeah,
Well, but on that latter point, it sounds like the driver in this is when along the continuum of an evaluation or a relationship leading to a full investment in a manager, that the investment staff needs to come back to the board. I'm not appreciating that maybe that's onerous or it's an interruption or it's in other words, I'm not appreciating what impact that can have. One thing I've learned about our investments over time is that nothing happens quickly. It seems to me that this is a very thoughtful, deliberate due diligence process and always has been. And I'm pleased about that. In other words, we don't do anything quickly and for damn good reason. So I'm just trying to understand along that timeline, that continuum, when does the disadvantage occur if you don't have $250 million in your pocket versus the $100 million you have now?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, Scott. So one point I'd like to make on this is that, you know, we have a very robust due diligence process, and we have a long courting process as we try to get comfortable with managers. However, there is urgency with some of the private equity funds that we engage with. And I think one critical difference, you know, with the managers we're targeting now, many of these managers have a one and done close. So from the time that they start their process to they finish their process, sometimes it's 3 months. And what they've done is they've already spoken to the existing LP base, and the existing LP base would take down the entire fund if they could. So let's, for argument's sake, say it's an $8 billion fund. These managers often have more than $8 billion in interest from the existing limited partners. And so they reserve a small piece of the new fund for new limited partners. And those new limited partners need to work quickly and efficiently get through their due diligence process to be able to provide some level of conviction that they would want to make that investment in order to get into the fund. So, for example, one of the first commitments we made in our private equity program, some of the feedback we got was that what helped us to get into that fund was that we completed our due diligence first. We got our legal doc comments in first, and that manager used that as an objective criteria in whether to allow LPs to come into that fund. And so there is an urgency in many cases, even though the courting process can be long. So, you know, for example, I tried to reach out to managers several years before their fundraise. In some cases, those managers don't take meetings with us for the first year. And then towards the end of the process, they say, we have some availability in the fund if you can get there in a month. And we've had situations like that where we've had to move very quickly to be able to see if we could get there. In those scenarios, our due diligence is always robust. We never compromise on our due diligence, but there are several situations where urgency has been important. And what's driving this is just how competitive the market is to get into some of these funds. Many of these funds they're saying no to many blue chip LPs. You know, one of the funds in their marketing materials has it front and center that they're very selective with the LPs that they partner with. You know, frankly, I would prefer for Cicera and for our members that the market wasn't this competitive and it wasn't as in favor of the general partners. The negotiating power wasn't as in favor of the general partners, but this is the environment that we're currently in, and there is sometimes urgency that's needed in these processes.
Rishi, without mentioning any names, because I'm not asking for specifics, and I'm also not making a case to leave that dollar amount the way it is today, can you count the number of instances in which we may have been locked out of something because we couldn't hit the price of admission at $100 million?
So far we haven't had to deal with that because we've been able to use staff discretion. I think just to give you a sense, I think the open questions, if we were not able to use staff discretion, open questions would be, what level of comfort do some of these private equity managers have in the sharing of the information? What do they consider proprietary? Can we present something in a board setting that, quite frankly, our investment team is comfortable with, that we feel like the board has the information they need to make the investment decision in that scenario? I think there are some open questions there. And I think this boils down to, is this, to me anyway, is this in the ordinary course of implementing the private markets program? And I think based on the pacing, based on the commitment sizes, based on how frequently funds come back to market, I think this, a dollar increase in staff discretion would allow for implementation to occur in the ordinary course in my view, rather than it, being sort of an extraordinary circumstance. And I think Scott's touched on it, Tim's touched on it. It's the growth of the overall portfolio. It's the increase in pacing that I think is leading to some of this discussion.
Yeah. What I'm taking as a response there is, even though we maybe we're hitting a lack of headroom here, but I still haven't heard from you yet that we have any practical examples of where we have been locked out. Maybe we're close to being locked out because of a discretionary limit, but I haven't heard from you that we have actually had that happen.
Jerry, that's correct. It has not happened, but it is on our imminent radar. When we take a look at the funds that are going to be coming back to market over the next 2 years, where we have a fair degree of Rishi's got a fair degree of visibility that they're coming back, and incorporating the new pacing analysis from StepStone about how big of a bite size we would like to have, then we're starting to see that becomes the trigger point is going to be met if we don't have a policy change here. So it has not occurred today. We don't want it to, have that pinch point. We want to get ahead of this and obviously address trustee concerns well in advance of, locking us out of quality investments. And that's why we're having the discussion today. And, I would just echo Gail's point. It's, if there's additional language, if there's changes, that's great. But I think it's important to have this fiduciary discussion of, us saying from the staff level, here's where we're seeing some pinch points coming up. And you from trustees saying, here's where our comfort level is. And let's see if we can find, some common ground there. And obviously, I think that's what Scott has tried to facilitate in the policy level discussion here.
And keeping in mind that this is more than just time and grade, right? This is about ramping up the program to meet the new strategic asset allocation. So it's important to consider that as well.
Scott, one consideration let me throw out is a higher level for private equity than everything else. All of this discussion on the need for the increase appears to revolve around private equity.
Yeah, private markets broadly, yeah.
Private markets, yes. So one of the things you might look at is that 250 doesn't apply to everything. It applies, or whatever higher number we might end up reaching, applies to private markets.
And John, that's something we can certainly take a look at. I think from a practical standpoint, if you take a look at the other strategies in our lineup, they're overwhelmingly significantly larger. So if we're talking public equity mandates, we're saying several hundred million dollars is kind of the typical size there. That's not to say we couldn't have a smaller one, but just operationally and by the evidence of history, this has become, this is more relevant in the private market space because public market mandates by their very nature are larger. and by their very nature are less bound to tight timelines and that sort of thing. So we just have a lot more operational flexibility there. We underwrite a long only equity strategy. Candidly, it can, that due diligence process can take 2 to 3 times longer because there's not the urgency from the manager side of that. They're shutting off new money coming into it. But we can certainly be bringing those and have been bringing those in front of the board. It's the private markets where there's some operational constraints there. But I think it's more the, I don't think it's the dollar limit as much, because the dollar limit isn't going to be as relevant for things outside the private market space, because they're simply larger already.
Well, I get my reaction to this is that there should be some more discussion on this. I'm still not fully understanding that timeline of why a board approval derails the entire operation at any amount, whether it's the current 100 million or it's the proposed 250 or something in between. I'm just not appreciating fully yet what the aspect of seeking and obtaining board approval for the balance of an investment. That, for instance, let's just make up a number. You're looking at something that's 220. And if your current authority is 100 without board approval, when along the timeline is it appropriate to know or feel that you need the additional 120? And does that process alone derail your ability to invest in the particular manager or the particular strategy? That would help me to understand a little better where our role impedes you in that timeline as being someone who's asked to approve or to bless the additional expenditure. Anyway, something for us to discuss.
Yeah, we can certainly take a look at mapping out current practice and future growth and kind of where that crossover point is that we're seeing there.
What sounded like, I think what I picked up from what Rishi said, what was that, particularly in the private equity space or in some parts of it, the pace is pretty accelerated. It's different than it was. And because of the increased competition, the timeline is shorter. I'm just trying to get an appreciation of what that timeline actually is and where along that grand continuum, seeking or obtaining approvals for funding interrupt that or potentially derail it.
Yes. Hi, Scott. So I think it depends on the timeline. So, what we do is we stay in touch with the best in class managers in the pipeline. They have a fundraising timeline in mind. Sometimes we aren't privy to when that fundraising timeline is, because how they started is they reach out to the existing LP base and they don't make an announcement in the market necessarily that they're fundraising. They just speak to the existing LP base. And then, we've been trying to nurture a relationship with them over time. In some cases, they might reach out to us immediately after they have initial interest from the existing LP base, and then maybe we'll have 2 months to do due diligence and get from beginning to end in the process. There are other situations where maybe we aren't positioned as strongly, and they've gone through the existing LP base, they've gone through the likely LPs that they want, and then maybe one of the likely LPs drops out for a particular reason, and they might contact us and say, hey, if you guys can get there in a month, we need, you might have a shot at getting allocation here. So it depends a little bit from process to process. One thing I'd say is that, today, if the managers that we've chosen perform well, and we hope that they do, you know, what we do know based on the existing discretion amount is that we will need to bring these managers to the board. So if we've made a decision with staff discretion, the manager's performing well, there haven't been changes to the team or the strategy, and the existing portfolio is performing well, we would need to bring that to the board because of the pacing and the pacing that we're targeting. We would have an, you know, greater than $100 million exposure per manager. Thinking about a $2 billion private equity program, you know, if we have 15 to 20 managers, you're going to be at that number. But then the other thing to take into account is that they're coming to market every 2 to 3 years. So it's the pace that they're coming to market at that's also playing into this. Historically, private equity managers might raise capital every 4 to 5 years, and maybe, you know, this dollar amount would be a lower dollar amount would be easier for us to execute operationally. But with managers coming back to market 2 to 3 years, we still have capital outstanding with these managers when they're coming back to market. And so almost all of these fund managers will need to be brought to the board. It won't be an extraordinary situation. It will be more of an ordinary course to implement the program. We'd be bringing them to the board.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? So this is listed as an action item. I've heard a lot of discussion with regards to, you know, concerns by trustees. What is the will of the board at this time? Do you want to have another educational session? What say you guys?
Can I just summarize sort of where I think we stand today?
That would be great. Thank you, Scott.
It's a lot of good discussion. It seems like, so I presented three areas, broad areas of change, right? The first was to change the liquidity pool from 48 down to 36 months and the changes that go along with that, which were really pretty minor, but impactful. And then the other one was just general improvement opportunities. It seems like all this discussion is around the middle piece, right? So just to be clear on that, it's around the involvement of trustees in the due diligence process and maybe tightening that up around intent, making the words, because words matter, making the words reflect the intent, and then also around the $250 million authority level. So we've boiled it down, I think, to two areas that may still need some work. And so there's my summary.
Yeah, so, I get the sense that I'm not prepared to approve these changes without having the opportunity for Scott and Tim and Rishi to be able to incorporate some additional discussion about how they might be able to tighten this up. So I'd prefer to have it come back.
Makes sense.
I wonder if it's possible to approve the other two areas, and so that we don't have to re-engage in that discussion and just focus really on the one area around staff authority.
Which specifically are you talking about, Scott?
Changing 48 months to 36 months in the liquidity pool, and then all the sort of the little knit adjustments, right? And really, so approve everything but the $250 million authority and the language around staff involvement in the due diligence process.
I'm good with that.
Same here.
Well, you know, I don't want to wordsmith that. I don't have any trouble. I don't think anybody has any trouble, I would surmise, with the change in the number of months, because that's something we've actually already determined. It's just a question of the policy being updated to state it. But I don't know if I want to haul past all the other nits without going through it again. I did read it carefully and I read it several times. And we've hit the big ticket items, but there were a number of edits that were interesting. Okay. So I would definitely support the 4-year to 3-year change, obviously, because we've already decided that. But I would want the rest to come back. That would be my preference.
I agree.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I'll call for a vote.
Sorry, Todd.
Oh, I'm okay. It didn't.
Specifically, the motion is to approve the 3-year versus 4-year.
That's my understanding of John's motion, yes.
Yes.
Correct.
As described by Scott.
Okay. So if there are no further questions or clarifications, and I'm not seeing anyone, I'll call for the vote. Anderson?
Aye.
Finley?
Aye.
Gordon?
Aye.
Holcomb?
Aye.
Kroll?
Aye.
McDonald?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Smithy? Aye. And Watts?
Aye.
Okay, motion passes 9-0. And Scott and Tim, do you feel like you understand what the board's looking for when you bring the item back before us?
I think I do.
I think so, yes.
Okay, great. Well, then thank you both and Rishi for that discussion. And we'll look forward to seeing this on a future agenda item. So that completes the agenda while being in a different order. So earlier, the board voted to adjourn the meeting in honor of Denise Bizzuto. And so we will do just that. So thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Scott?